Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today, Jim Tedder tells us about the origins of a well-known phrase in American English. We will have that story for you later in the program. We will also introduce a new part of our program called Word of the Day. Ashley Thompson will tell us what that word is. But first, the Supreme Court in Venezuela recently canceled some decisions of its National Assembly. The oil-rich South American country is already suffering from an economic crisis. Now, it appears to be entering a time of political instability. Christopher Jones Cruz has more.
Oil-rich Venezuela appears to be entering a time of political instability. The conflict between the socialist government of President Nicolas Maduro and the opposition-controlled National Assembly is worsening. Earlier, a court ruled that three opposition members could not be part of the assembly. But last week, the legislature defied the order and made them members. On Monday, the Supreme Court ruled that the assembly cannot move forward until the three opposition lawmakers are removed. The three give the opposition enough votes in the assembly to remove Supreme Court justices. With their votes, the assembly can also write a new constitution and permit citizens to vote on legislation. Last month, the opposition coalition Democratic Unity Roundtable won parliamentary elections. Sean Burgess studies South American politics. He is a researcher at the Australian National University. He says the best that can be hoped for now is that both sides will understand that the conflict can be an opportunity to reach agreement.
In a sense, I'm not quite sure what can happen here. I mean, if the Congress is suspended, the court's going to have to act. Is Maduro going to act by decree? I mean, it creates a constitutional crisis, but in a sense, does it matter if Maduro just keeps going on doing what he's doing? And then it gets interesting to see what happens with regional neighbors. Will people like President Macri in Argentina then start to make noises about Venezuela having become an autocracy? So it's going to be a very complicated game, and I'm not sure that anybody really knows the way out just at the moment.
He says the president and the opposition need to work together to improve the economy, which has been in a recession. The country is also suffering from high inflation, a shortage of goods, rising crime, and falling oil prices. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. When we return, Ashley Thompson will have our Word of the Day.
We'll be right back. And now, our word of the day. Today's word is desk. Desk is a noun. A desk is a piece of furniture that is like a table and often has drawers. Here are two examples using the word desk. He sits at his desk. She drinks coffee at her desk. And that's the word of the day.
Thousands of news articles said Joaquin Guzman had been on the lam since his escape from a maximum security prison in July. But what does on the lam mean? And where did the expression come from? Jim Tedder has the answers.
Drug gang leader Joaquin Guzman was recaptured Friday by Mexican Marines after 6 months on the lam. Many in America know that on the lam means on the run or hiding from police, especially after escaping from jail or prison. That perfectly describes what Guzman was doing. Last July, he escaped from a maximum security prison and had been hiding from police, moving from place to place. On the lam is an informal phrase used almost exclusively in the United States. LearnersDictionary.com says the expression is now used mainly to suggest or imitate the language of old movies about gangsters. Movies about gangsters or criminals are popular around the world. But where did such an odd phrase come from? In other words, what are its origins? The Online Etymology Dictionary says the word lam means flight or to run off. It may come from the expression on the lam, which appeared in the late 1890s in the United States. William Safire wrote many columns about language before he died in 2009. In 1998, he wrote about On the Lam in the New York Times newspaper. He noted that the origin of the expression is in heated dispute among slang etymologists, or people who study words. Safire notes that the famous American writer Mark Twain used the word lam or lambing twice in his books, in 1855 and 1865. When anyone who has been on the lam has been recaptured, news writers often say the person will now have to face the music. We will tell you about this expression soon. I'm Jim Tedder.
And that's our program for today. Keep listening for today's education report and for our history program, The Making of a Nation. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Today, we continue our series of expert suggestions for academic writing. Our guest is Jennifer Ahern Dodson, Assistant Professor of the Practice in Writing Studies at Duke University in North Carolina. Ms. Ahern Dodson starts a conversation with both students and professors planning to write a paper or essay. She asks about their earlier writing experiences. Were they negative or positive? She advises that you are not alone if you have had problems with your writing. She says everyone struggles with writing.
Writing is hard. All writers struggle at some point. And even if writing has come easy for you at some point in your work as a student, that eventually you're going to hit a roadblock. And so part of what I like to get folks thinking about, besides writing hard for everybody, is to really take a moment to think about their past writing experiences and when the writing was going well, what was happening. When the writing wasn't going well, what was happening.
She says most people's negative writing experiences happen because a very special formula is required for a paper, including an exact length.
And so they primarily focus on and worry about what the final product has to look like how many pages of a research essay, or if it is second or third language, you know, punctuation, grammar, like making sure it gets communicated in the right language. And so focusing on the end makes it really hard to get started.
Another problem can arise when the need to do well on a paper is extremely important.
Like a timed essay exam or a college application essay or a research paper that is at the end of the semester and it's tied to the entire grade for the class. So worrying about what would happen if they don't do well, like bad grades, don't get into college, creates, of course, significant anxiety, and that can make it harder to get the writing done.
Then she and the people she's helping move to more positive projects. She says usually when writing comes easily, the writers feel they have something important to say. The teacher advises asking yourself questions. What personal understanding of the subject can you bring to your paper? Why is this subject important? For whom is it meaningful? Who will be reading it?
Think about who your audience is and what it is that you really want to say to them. What that can do is help you switch the focus from the final product and what it can look like and really more on what you have to offer, your particular perspective.
She says that is an important change for all writers. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report. Coming soon, Jennifer Ahern Dodson talks about doing research, sitting down to write, and sharing your writing with others. I'm Jerry Watson.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. During the second half of the 19th century, the United States was not concerned much with events in other countries. It was too busy dealing with events inside its own borders. At that time, the nation was recovering from the Civil War. it was expanding to the West, and it was developing industries. As production increased, the United States began trading more and more with other countries. At the same time, it needed a new foreign policy to defend its interests. This week in our series, Morris Joyce and Larry West discuss America's foreign policy in the late 1800s.
A growing number of lawmakers called for a new foreign policy. One was Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts. Lodge said, "The great nations of the world were taking control of the world's undeveloped areas." As one of the great nations, Lodge said, "The United States must not fall out of this line of march." Another lawmaker said, "Fate has written our policy. The trade of the world must and shall be ours." Some of these ideas came from the writings of Captain Alfred Mahan. He was head of America's Naval War College. Mahan wrote that all the great nations in history had possessed great sea power. He said the United States must build up its sea power, too, if it wanted to be a great nation. Sea power, Mahan said, was more than a strong navy. It was an economy that could produce goods for export. It was trade ships that could carry the goods. It was colonies that could supply raw materials and markets. And it was overseas naval bases that could defend American interests far from home.
The Washington Post newspaper described America's growing power this way: "A new understanding seems to have come upon us, an understanding of our strength, and with it, a new feeling. We want to show our strength. We are face to face with a strange fate. The taste of empire is in the mouth of the people." The Washington Post was not speaking for everyone, of course. In fact, many American presidents of the late 1800s did not have this taste for empire. Yet, they were forced to face the future. Changes were coming, and it was their responsibility to guide the nation through the changes. For this reason, the United States entered into several agreements with foreign lands during the late 1800s.
In 1878, for example, the United States signed a treaty with Samoa. The United States agreed to help the South Pacific Islands settle any differences with other nations. A few years later, the treaty was put to a test. A group of Germans living in Samoa forced the island's ruler from power. They replaced him with a ruler who was more friendly to Germany. For a time, it seemed the United States and Germany would go to war. But when American warships arrived in Samoa, so did a big storm. The storm smashed both American and German ships. Neither side was left with a force strong enough to fight. In 1889, the United States, Germany, and Britain agreed that Samoa should be an independent kingdom. For 10 years, local leaders attempted to establish a strong government. Their efforts failed. In 1899, Germany took control of Samoa's large western islands. The United States took control of the smaller islands to the east.
Events in another group of Pacific Ocean islands affected American foreign policy in the late 1800s. These were the Hawaiian Islands. Hawaii was an important port for American trade ships sailing between the United States and China. Good relations between Hawaii and the United States were necessary to keep the port open to American ships. In 1891, Liliuokalani became Queen of Hawaii. She was not friendly to the United States. A group of American businessmen and planters in Hawaii plotted to oust her. The group started an uprising. Then it called on the United States for protection. Queen Liliuokalani was forced to surrender. The businessmen and planters formed a new government. They wanted Hawaii to be part of the United States. By the end of the century, Congress had made Hawaii an American territory.
The United States also offered to serve as a negotiator in several international disputes during the late 1800s. One dispute involved Britain and Venezuela. Both countries claimed land that bordered the British colony of Guyana on the northeast coast of South America. The situation became tense when gold was discovered in the disputed area. The United States offered to negotiate an agreement. Britain refused the offer. The United States offered again. Britain refused again. Finally, President Grover Cleveland asked the United States Congress to appoint a committee to decide the border. Before the American committee had a chance to meet, Britain and Venezuela agreed to let an international committee decide.
In 1895, Cuban rebels revolted against the colonial government. They tried to destroy the economy of the island by burning private property. Spain sent a large force to Cuba to crush the revolt. Thousands of persons were arrested and put into prison camps. Many died of hunger and disease. Spain was denounced for its cruelty.
It was difficult to get a true picture of what was happening in Cuba. American newspapers sent reporters to the island. But much of what they wrote about never happened. The reporters knew very well that exciting and horrifying stories sold newspapers. So they made up stories about bloody battles and Spanish cruelty. One incident has become famous in American newspaper history. Publisher William Randolph Hearst sent artist Frederick Remington to Cuba to paint pictures of the fighting. Remington spent several months in Havana. He saw no fighting. He sent Hearst a message. Things were quiet, Remington said. There would be no war. Hearst sent back this answer. You supply the pictures. I'll supply the war.
The newspaper built up strong public feeling against Spain. Soon, many Americans were calling for war to free Cuba from Spanish rule. William McKinley was president. He did not want the United States to become involved. He did, however, offer to help Spain find a solution that would return peace to the island. Spain refused the offer. It attempted to improve the situation in Cuba by itself. Spain called home the military commander accused of cruelty. It stopped putting people in prison camps. It offered equal political rights to all Cubans, and it promised them self-rule in the future.
President McKinley welcomed Spain's policy statements. He felt Spain should be left alone to honor its promises to the Cuban people. He said the United States would not interfere. At about that time, however, riots broke out in Havana. President McKinley said it was his responsibility to protect the lives and property of Americans living there. So he sent the battleship Maine to Havana. During the early weeks of 1898, President McKinley waited for Spain to act on its promises to Cuba. He saw little progress. Relations between the United States and Spain became tense. Then, on the night of February 15th, a powerful explosion shook the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor. The ship sank. More than 250 American sailors were dead.
No one knew what caused the explosion on the battleship Maine. The United States said it was an underwater bomb. Spain said it was something on the ship itself. There was some evidence the explosion was caused by an accident in the ship's fuel tanks. Yet, some people in the United States blamed Spain anyway. They demanded war. They cried, "Remember the Maine." That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Morris Joyce and Larry West. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.